This is Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Maine Public News Director Mark Simpson. This week, our politics team of Mal Leary and Steve Missler discuss recent bills of note with our Deputy News Director, Susan Sharon, and provide a pointed look at the conversation about civility in politics. But first, Augusta Bureau Chief Steve Missler explains there's some maneuvering going on in the State House over a bill evaluating the potential greenhouse reductions of CMP's proposed transmission lines.
The CMP, as part of its push to get this project approved and also sway public opinion, claims that the project will reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But opponents of that project are not convinced because that claim really hinges on whether Hydro-Québec, which is supplying the hydropower, is actually adding generation to accommodate the project, or if it's simply diverting existing power resources. If it's the latter, then opponents say there will be no carbon reductions because fossil fuel generators will have to be used, and therefore, you know, there will be more carbon spewed into the atmosphere. But if it's additive generation, then maybe the project will produce the reductions that CMP asserts. Now, this bill is sponsored by State Senator Brownie Carson, who is the former director of NRCM, or the Natural Resources Council of Maine, which is also a vigorous opponent of this project. That's sort of the setup that he's really pushing for this bill. NRCM really wants it. Now there's a lot of sort of backroom maneuvering about how to advance a study, even though that at the end of the day, such a study would have to be approved by Governor Janet Mills unless there's enough votes to override in a veto.
Yes, and one of the reasons Governor Mills has said that she really supports this project is because it's supposed to address climate change in the long run. So this study would seem to be fundamental to that argument. So it kind of puts her in a pickle, doesn't it? How is she going to resolve this?
You're absolutely right. If you recall, when she announced that she was supporting the project, she held up this cube of carbon to talk about its purported reductions, this project, how it would reduce carbon emissions, right? What I've heard is that the governor is on board with some sort of analysis, but it may not be exactly what NRCM and Senator Carson want. So they've been talking about ways to sort of resolve these differences, but those differences could be really significant, especially if NRCM gets this study that they want from an outside consultant, where I think what might happen, and maybe there'll be some news on this later, is that Mills would like to try to get Hydro-Québec involved because they're really key to resolving this key question about whether this power generation is additive or just simply being diverted. So maybe there'll be some movement there, but right now that's where we stand. They want to resolve this before there's a vote because they just really don't want to have a public dispute over this.
And the politics really are that Janet Mills wants these other factors like the electric car charging stations to start to go online. Well, that means having these permits in place and getting the project underway. And the whole idea of this climate change impact study is to slow down that process. So I think you're going to have some real problems with her going along with that kind of a study, if indeed it slows down in any way the normal process of permitting this project.
The governor is definitely concerned about that. And that is another issue, right? I mean, that's, I think, one reason why I think there's a difference between where she sits on this issue and where Senator Carson and NRCM sit.
One bill introduced this past week is the one granting unions more access to public sector employees for recruitment purposes. This was Democrats' response to a U.S. Supreme Court decision last year. What does this bill do and what are its chances?
So the bill basically tries to counteract that Supreme Court decision, which really centered around what are known as fair share fees that used to be required to be paid by public sector employees who didn't want to be in the union, but the union still had to represent in collective bargaining negotiations and if there was a grievance with their employer. And so the Supreme Court effectively prohibited those fair share payments. And so what Democratic legislatures around the country and now Maine are trying to do is to give unions more access to new employees. What the bill would effectively do was provide new hires contact information, email, phone numbers, so that the union could reach out and say, hey, you know, you should really think about being in the union. Now, you can already envision how this is being set up from a potential opponents of this, which is, this is private information. Why are we giving it to unions? so that they can, you know, pad their coffers, et cetera. And, you know, we don't know if that's exactly how the arguments will roll out when there's a public hearing on the bill later this month. But that's what the bill is designed to do. And I think it'll be a pretty spirited debate, too, I think.
So, Mal Leary, where are we in the session when it comes to spirited debates, as Steve mentioned, and some of the big issues remaining? What are your optics on this so far? It seems like they've been put off.
Well, they have been put off. We've seen a number of divided reports just set on the calendars in the House and Senate. To Steve's bill, it is one of many labor bills dealing with minimum wage, dealing with workers' compensation that have kind of been flying under the radar here, which are very important, which have folks really excited on both sides, be it the labor unions or the business community. But they haven't spilled over into public yet because we haven't had those floor debates that will draw attention. And I think it's part of a deliberate attempt by the Democrats, who control both the agenda in both the House and Senate, to try to keep these controversial bills from becoming too controversial, too heated, and, to use the vernacular of the day, uncivil, because there have been some pretty nasty debates in the past, although none of these debates in recent times have risen to the early gay rights debates, which were so bad that at times the speaker would clear the high school students out of the gallery because of the things that were being said on the floor of the House. So let's put a little bit of perspective here that in the past we've really had some really, really uncivil debates. These, though, are trying to be avoided by the leadership of both the Senate and the House. And that results in bills staying in committee longer than they should. Once they're out, setting on the calendar without debate. Perfect example of one we've just had was the bill changing Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. When it got to the Senate, they debated it. Now, normally you would expect a vote, you know, 18, 19 for it, against it, maybe even a roll call vote, which is what the House did. No, there was no recorded vote. So we're not exactly sure how much support that bill has in the state Senate, because in essence, to use the phrase, it went under the gavel with no recorded vote. And that's part of trying to tone down the debate so that people don't get carried away and say things that they might be embarrassed about on the floor of the House and Senate.
And that bill still has further votes to go in both the House and Senate, to be clear. Well, speaking of civility, NPR has been running a series of reports on civility over the past couple of weeks. And just this past week, one of the stories included a report that looked at the quote-unquote unusual seating arrangement in the main House so that Democrats and Republicans would be seated next to each other. It featured House Speaker Sarah Gideon. Steve Missler, is there any indication so far, any evidence that that new seating chart, which is also being done in the Senate, is it helping civility?
First of all, let me just address one thing about that story and how it characterized the seating chart, especially in the House. There's 151 seats in the House of Representatives, and there are 16 examples of Democrats and Republicans sitting next to one another. That is not a lot. And even if you were to include adjacency, people sitting behind or sitting in front of one another, there's just about two dozen. But if you were to listen to that story, you were to be left with the impression that the entire chamber is Republican, Democrat, Republican, Democrat. It's just not the way it is. There are entire swaths of that chamber that are solid R and solid D. That aside, this is not a novel concept, this seating arrangement. See Congress seating at recent State of the Union addresses where they were, you know, required to sit next to one another, maybe not more recently under the Trump administration, but certainly during the Obama years. And then there's this alternate seating in legislative committees even. At the end of the day, these are sort of feel-good gestures, but they don't really translate into long-term outcomes that make our debates more civil. I mean, I just haven't seen evidence of that. And this seating arrangement, to the extent that it exists in the main House, will really be put to the test when we see some of these big debates, including the conversion therapy bill, which was featured in this story, which was ignited a very uncivil debate last year. That's up again this year. So we'll see if they can hold it together up there with this seating arrangement.
And by the way, am I correct that the representative who was featured in the NPR story in the conversion therapy debate is not among the people who are seated next to each other now?
That's exactly right. You know, this representative is sitting off in an island pretty much along with, and you could actually, you know, speculate about how these seating arrangements came to be, because a lot of these folks that are sitting next to one another are actually probably less partisan by nature, so they don't have a problem sitting next to somebody from the other side of the aisle, if you will. I mean, the thing that I have to say about this hand-wringing about incivility is that it's really hard to square it with the current political environment that we're in. I mean, Trump, Governor LePage, and arguably some of these firebrands that are emerging on the left are about as divisive as political figures as you can get. And they have arguably risen to prominence because of that. I mean, among them, you know, is this sort of chief characteristic of insulting their opponents or clapping back at them, calling them traitors and un-American and you name it. And none of them have ever paid an electoral price for that behavior. And you just look at Governor LePage. He was elected twice, you know, routinely displaying this kind of conduct. And the second time, he was rewarded for that conduct because more voters voted for him that the second time than the first time. So I just don't know how you reconcile that with the polls that say the public wants their elected officials to be more civil. Is it maybe that voters want their ideological opponents to be more civil, but they're not necessarily don't want the people that represent them or support their views to be civil? Or maybe that incivility is a feature and not a bug. It just seems to me that if you want more civil discourse, you stop electing uncivil politicians.
Because they campaign on it. Yeah. I mean, they're campaigning on getting tough, and then that's what they do.
We've got to look at the history here. Our electoral history has so many examples of extreme rhetoric as to be unbelievable. The 1800 election, where the adultery of one of the candidates for president was brought to bear. There was the Grover Cleveland situation where he was accused of fathering a child, and that was being used in the ads of the day in the newspapers attacking him. I mean, this is not new, folks. Mm-hmm. It's happened in cycles over the course of history, and I suspect that we're just at a cycle now of this sort of harsh rhetoric that eventually will right itself and people will get sick of it. But I'm not sure they're there yet, as Steve just mentioned, here in our state with Governor LePage getting elected twice and Donald Trump taking the second congressional district for an electoral vote. The pendulum's swung one way, Susan, and now we're waiting to see when it starts swinging back.
I don't know how you ever solve incivility, you know what I mean? At the end of the day, I mean, look at Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi. Arguably, those two people are civil, but they're also Machiavellian assassins, all right? So is it better to have that and have people be kind of phony nice to one another? Or is it better to just be out, you know, insulting each other on Twitter? I don't know that there's necessarily a difference. That's all I...
Well, you know, maybe not Twitter, but just in the arena.
But there's also a big difference between what I call the professional politicians, the people sitting in Congress who are more concerned about getting reelected than they are public policy, with a citizens' legislature. What I've seen happen here over the years that's most disconcerting is there used to be pickup basketball games between lawmakers, regardless of party. They just got together after the day and blew off some steam. They would get together at the senator and, you know, talk about stuff over meals. And that's not going on now. The Republicans get together and talk, and the Democrats get together and talk. And to the point Steve has made earlier, in the case of the Democrats, you got two different Democratic groups who may not be necessarily talking to one another. You know, if you walk into the Senator at night, you will see tables and, you know, four or five lawmakers at each table. But you won't see, except rarely, R's and D's together at the table. Mm-hmm. There used to be regular efforts by leadership to get together and have breakfast or get together to have dinner so that there's discussion about what's going on with issues, what's likely to come up. What tends to happen is when the Republicans were in control of both chambers, they basically kissed off the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing it this time, the Democrats who control both chambers, they're basically kissing off the Republicans.
All right. So the consensus between the two of you is that the seating chart is not going to do it for the foreseeable future, right?
Yeah.
All right. I don't think it's going to be the case.
That's Susan Sharon, Steve Missler, and Mal Leary. I'm Mark Simpson. For more on exactly what Steve and Mal make of that question of civility, catch the extended Political Pulse podcast online. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer, and join us again soon.